The Theosophical Society presents N. Sri Ram in a talk entitled The Law of Right Relationships.
The subject is the law of right relationship. But since I am no lawgiver, I shall not lay down the law. We will merely study the relationships which exist in the world, and then we will form an idea of what the relationship should be, and we will be able to deduce the law from our own observations. Because law is not something that is arbitrary, imposed by a decree or will. It is something which exists in nature. So it is open to perception by him who has his eyes open. Now let us see what is the relationship between two human beings as it ordinarily is, as we find it in the world. Each one of us is highly conditioned in one way or another. We need not object to that word conditioning. You know, it only means that we have been molded in a certain way. We have been taught to think along certain lines. I am a Hindu, and I look at the world as a Hindu with my background. You are Christian or Hebrew or Muslim, whatever it may be, and you look at things from your background. And we are conditioned by nationality, American, Russian, Indian, Pakistani, and so forth, and by everything that has happened to us. If I am a man with plenty of money, on economic questions, I have certain views which suit my position. If I don't have money, then of course my views are very different. So, a person is not born as a capitalist or employer or as a laboring man. He is in a certain position, and his views develop according to his convenience, he being situated where he is. So in all ways, we have been molded by so many different influences. And when two people who have been conditioned in different ways encounter each other, they have to deal with each other, live with each other, there is naturally conflict. This is inevitable so long as the situation is what it is. But even while there is conflict, there can be an area of agreement. There can be certain purposes which are common to the two individuals. And because of these common purposes, there is the possibility of what is called coexistence. You know that term very well, I presume. Yeah, there is coexistence between Russia and the Western countries, regardless of differences of interest, differences in ideology, because they both want to live on this planet. That is the common purpose which holds them together. Similarly, in the past in India, there has been a kind of coexistence between the Muslims and the Hindus. They had different viewpoints, but nevertheless, they had to get on together, so they came to some kind of an arrangement, not deliberately, But everything settles down, shakes down, so to say, in nature. When these differences are very pronounced, then there is the necessity for what is called adjustment, a favorite word in these modern days. You have to adjust. What does adjust mean? The adjusting is really a kind of mechanical term. When there are two pieces of wood which you have to put together, wood or metal, if they don't quite fit, you have to adjust them. You have to push the one and pull the other, turn them round in some way so that they will exist side by side for the purpose for which they are intended. And when this adjustment takes place, then they get on in an ordinary humdrum manner. Or when there are differences, each one gives way to some extent, and there is what we might call a compromise, which is a little different from adjustment. If a husband and wife are quarreling the whole time, the husband may say to the wife, "I will stay with you during the weekdays, but during the weekend I will be elsewhere." You know, that's a kind of compromise on the basis of which they carry on their lives. Now, this kind of conflict, which you find everywhere, it's a conflict in relationship. Sometimes the conflict may be in one's own mind. Very often it is. It implies a little measure of equality, at least in argument. They are able to argue with one another and come to an adjustment or compromise. But sometimes there may be no equality at all. If there is complete inequality, then there is a relationship of domination on the part of one and suppression on the part of another. You see this relationship between individuals, between two nations, between different economic sections in the population of a country. Colonialism really means domination of one people by another. So there is the suppression of the people who are governed. In racial relations, you see, there is the dominant side and there is the other side which is suppressed. And even in the relationship between man and woman, you see that, at least in the past, the man has been the predominant partner and the woman has been kept under subjection to a greater or less extent. I am sure you will recognize the truth of what I say. But whenever there is this relationship of dominance and subjection, you find that there is always a reaction to the suppression. The Russian Revolution burst upon the world all of a sudden. But the revolution was generated by forces that had accumulated over a long period under the ground. So there was an eruption like a volcanic eruption, but it is preceded by slow or rapid, gradual processes, which is always the case in nature. Whenever there is domination, whenever there is suppression, you will find that there is this reaction. A human being cannot avoid it. He may not express the reaction, but it is there smoldering in his heart. Sometimes the situation may be a situation of complete hopelessness for the person who is in the state of subjection. Then he might accept it. He might say he accepts slavery, but that is a way of reconciling himself. It is a kind of psychological adjustment. A person cannot always live in a state of tension. He must in some way resolve it. And if there is no way of resolving it, then the acceptance is a way of coming to terms with the situation, which keeps the individual in a state of comparative integrity within himself. So you see, a person may accept the hopeless, the inevitable, the destiny which is absolute. But if there is any chance of escape, then of course the person devises every possible plan of getting away from that situation which is so very difficult or distressing to him. You see this in the case of prisoners all over the world. If the prison treatment is harsh, then the prisoner is always thinking of some way of running away from the place. It is a very natural reaction. Of course, all the governments and the police people and the warders and so on, they think upon that as a proof of his own criminality. But a person will always want to escape from a situation which presses upon him from all sides and which makes life difficult for him. And if there is a possibility of fighting the warders, the superintendent for instance, then of course they will try, the prisoners I mean, will try to organize a fight and see whether they cannot get the better of the situation in that manner. So we see that wherever there is suppression, there is always this resentment building up. Now, this is true even with regard to the individual. What is suppressed reacts, you know, it presses. And in the individual also, you may try to suppress something by force. You find some emotion which you want to suppress. You will find that the suppression is only temporary, but actually it becomes more intense. The virus gets stronger when it is bottled up, and sooner or later, the suppressed emotions or feelings will burst out apparently with redoubled strength. So we see that wherever there is suppression, there is always this reaction. So suppression does not really solve any human problem, whether it is a problem in relationship between two people or whether it is a problem in the human being himself, who is complex, composed of many parts, and there has to be a relationship of harmony between those different parts or aspects of that being. So all that suppression does is to drive it into underground, that is to say in society, into the subconscious, if that is the case with the individual. So it remains in the subconscious, and after a time the person may not even be aware of the fact that he is full of resentment towards the other person. The feelings of resentment, they accommodate themselves so beautifully in the person's breast that he is not conscious of it. Suppose you are settled in a chair and you absolutely fit into it on all sides. You are in a situation of perfect comfort. You will find that you are unconscious of the presence of the chair. You will not know it at all because you have so perfectly adapted yourself to the contours of the chair. We will never be conscious of any situation to which we absolutely adapt ourselves. And of course, there is no possibility of progress when there is that perfect adaptation. So you may say, what is the way out of this problem? One has, in some manner, to resolve the complex which exists. Suppression produces a complex, and a complex is really a knot. You know, we use rather learned modern terms, and we think we understand a great deal. But other words have been used in the past, and they explain or describe the situation equally well. In the old books, they have spoken of the knots of the heart, K-N-O-T, not N-O-T, knots of the heart. If there is a knot within one's nature, if there is something twisted, if there is some kind of an entanglement, then it has to be unraveled with care. You cannot merely drive it down. Or, of course, you may say, why not cut the Gordian knot? You know, we have heard that phrase. So without considering whether there is a possibility of cutting, because we are acquainted with the phrase, immediately it comes up to our mind, when there is a knot, why not cut it? Perhaps there is a way of dissolving the knot which is cutting. That is, you have to go to the root of the problem. Why that complex arose at all? What are the different reactions present in that mental state? And towards what they were reacting? If you understand yourself to that extent, that will be a complete resolution of the particular complication or complex from which you may be suffering. But fortunately, all things in nature come to an end. Life, however long, ends in death. I do not know whether you would consider it as a consolation or as a tragedy. Anyhow, a period of domination always comes to an end. The rule of the czars in Russia, to which communism is really a reaction, it existed for centuries, but then eventually it came to an end. Perhaps nature is too slow in her action. We think that the period of suffering should come quickly to an end. It doesn't. But anyhow, it comes to an end. So you see the system of slavery, for instance, which has existed on this planet for a very long period of time, not only in the United States, it has now more or less come to an end, except in isolated places and in a veiled form without a proper acknowledgement. Slavery does not exist. I have referred already to colonialism. It looked even some 10 years ago that all the peoples of Africa, being, according to our notions, somewhat primitive, were bound to continue in that state, ruled by other people. But you see that they have been able to gain their freedom in one way or another. It may be by mere shouting, by demonstrations. They might have been rolling on the floor, but whatever they did, they have been effective in getting what they wanted. So we see that there is always, before there is the ending of the conflict, a period during which there is conflict in another form. It is in an open form, and it aims at the overthrow of the existing system. In India, before the British rule came to an end, there was a long period of agitation, sometimes constitutional, sometimes unconstitutional, demonstration in the streets, meetings, passing resolutions, action by the police on the other hand, people going to prison and so on and so forth. So eventually the problem was settled. So finally there comes about a certain balance, that is to say an agreement on the part of the two sides to cooperate. This is always what happens historically and between individuals. Now this agreement to coexist, to cooperate, to get on with one another is merely a temporary thing. You know the word coexistence. I have never come across a word which sounds so very miserable, because are we merely to exist with others on this planet? Is that the relationship that we are going to aim at? It seems to me that perhaps there can be something better than that. But so much of our own existence is really a kind of coexistence. The ever so many marriages in the world are just states of coexistence. Of course, when a person enters into a marriage, he of course enters it with a thrill. But gradually the thrill ceases, and then it sometimes becomes a case of merely getting on with the other person, because if there is any kind of separation or divorce, there are various problems which the individual do not want to land themselves in. So we see that all this is not really the true relationship between two human beings, two individuals. The true relationship is not a relationship between two forms of conditioning. I have become this way you have become that way, and we have to throw over a bridge, as it were, between the two forms of conditioning. But a bridge is not the same as a happy union. There may be a bridge between a husband and wife. Perhaps the son may be the bridge, or there may be some near relative who may happen as a kind of reconciler between the two. But surely the bridge is not the same as real union or cooperation. True relationship is always a relationship between the truth in oneself and the truth in another. Of course, I am putting it somewhat abstractly. You might say, what is meant by this truth in oneself? Whatever is not false, whatever is not just made up, whatever is not artificial, that is the truth. The truth in one person, what he is in himself, in his own God-given nature, if you put it like that, it has to express itself in every situation according to the possibilities. Whatever the situation a human being in, his own intrinsic nature, not the acquired nature, built-up nature, made-up nature, not that nature which has been processed, which has been indoctrinated, which has been done over, you know, not that nature, but his own intrinsic nature, the truth of it, has to find expression in every relationship, in every circumstance, under all conditions. And it will express itself according to the situation that exists. Suppose I, instead of saying, using the word truth, I say, the true relationship is between what you might call the spiritual individuality of the one human being and the spiritual individuality or nature of the other. That is to say, it is a relationship between two natures, both of which are still in their natural state. They have not yet become conditioned. They have not yet become artificial. The word unconditioned sounds negative. If you say the unconditioned nature, not qualified in any way, not limited, not this, not Muslim, not Christian, but just a human being, not an African, not colored, not white, not green, not yellow. You see, now, that kind of unconditioned nature may sound negative, but it is really the ground from which spring the most positive forms of beauty. It is really the virgin soil which is eternally fertile. It is really a kind of immaculate nature from which whatever arises is of dreamlike beauty. It is just truth, it is just wisdom. And there is that possibility, or there is that basis of immaculateness in every single human being. It is his own fundamental nature, the native nature, that nature which is essential, which is deep down, which has been unaffected, which is not corrupt in any way, which is still undefiled, untouched. There is that nature in the individual, and if that nature can only become open, can come into contact with the actuality of things, then it will express itself in its own way from moment to moment. And this spiritual individuality, I don't want to use abstract terms which convey very little meaning to other people. We must avoid all terms which we cannot understand, which are unintelligible to our minds. Or if you use the term, use it understanding that you don't know what it is, the meaning of it. Well, this spiritual individuality, suppose I put it this way, it is really the loveliness in each, which you perceive in the individual when you are in a state of love. When you fall in love with a person, then you perceive what is really lovely in the other person. And perhaps it is that loveliness which is the true individuality, or at least it belongs to the truth of the individual. So the only true relationship is really a relationship of love. Love in a beautiful sense. It is not the same as mere lust, you know, as wanting to make use of the other person in order to gain a gratification from that person. I am not referring to that. When I say love, I mean love. It is really a relationship of love, not a relationship of possession. If you want to possess the other person, well, you may possess the other person, or you think you possess, but you don't have love. That doesn't necessarily generate love. Possession is merely colonialism and domination and so on, that is in another form in the individual. It is really a relationship. True love is really a relationship in which there is the experience of freedom. When you really feel love, there you will experience this feeling. I don't like to use the word sensation, but perhaps I might use it just in this sentence. You have the sensation of freedom. You experience a freedom. There is no tension. You are utterly relaxed. You don't have to adapt yourself to the person. You are just what you are. And can we have a relationship with another person in which you do not try to play up to him, to alter yourself, to adjust yourself, to come to a compromise, or in any way be other than what you inwardly are? So there is that feeling of freedom always along with love. And it is only love which will open the eye, so to say, the eye which perceives the true nature in each thing, the loveliness that is concealed there. Now, when I say a relationship of freedom, I really mean psychological freedom, not the freedom so-called which so many people are seeking. That is merely to be free from one thing in order to entangle oneself with another thing. I don't mean that kind of freedom, but it is a freedom within oneself. Suppose I put it this way. It is a freedom in which the mind is at rest, in which it does not rove, in which it does not seek something else, in which it is not in a state of rolling onward. But it can come to a state of rest only in that freedom. And that alone is love in the most beautiful, the real, the spiritual sense, in which there is that freedom and that state of rest, in which you feel free to be yourself. There is no tension, no effort to present yourself or make yourself into something other than what you are. Ordinarily, it is not so. Unfortunately, we human beings, what we are, where there is love between two people, usually there is expectation. The wife must minister to the comfort of her husband. That is expected. It is not written in the contract, so to say, but she is there in order to please him, in order to provide him with food, in order to give him all the satisfaction that he wants. If she no longer ministers to his comfort or pleasures, then of course there will be reasons for changing to somebody else. So what the person really wants is the satisfaction, and the other person is merely an instrument for the satisfaction. If the instrument does not perform as desired, then you can get another instrument in the market, and possibly there are others. So we see that this is what is happening. We have to become aware of that. We may use the word affection, we may use the word love. They are all beautiful words. It's like the package on the gift, you know, the gift package as they call it. It is all made so presentable. Now, but what is the intrinsic quality of the thing? So when there is love, ordinarily we find in so many cases that there is always an expectation, many expectations, and that is really the cause of all disappointment. Blessed is he who expects nothing, for he shall not be disappointed. You know, you have not only to fulfill or meet the expectations of the other person, you have to meet the expectations, you have to return the love according to the notions of the other person. You may think you are returning the love, but then the other person, doesn't find that you are returning. He or she has her or his own notions. That's the way in which this love should be returned. Otherwise, there is disappointment, and later on perhaps there is quarrel. And an extraordinary thing over this quarrel is that neither person really understands the cause of the quarrel. It is usually over some trivial matter. But the trivial thing which happens is not the real cause of the quarrel. The whole thing has been accumulating in the breast of each one, and that finds vent in that little incident. Sometimes we say, I don't know why he should take offense at that little thing. I didn't mean anything. It was so small, but somehow the person became enormously offended. Well, you may be sure that that is not the real reason for all the offense and the resentment. It is something else. Perhaps some previous incident, or it is a feeling which has been built up over a period of time and has remained hidden, and one day it just bursts out because there was a tiny hole, as it were, which has served as an outlet for all these feelings. So we see that in our relations with people, there is so often an element of bargaining. There is a kind of commercialism in the relations between two people which vitiates the relationship. So it is for each one of us to find out how far in his attitude, in his thinking, in all his emotions and behavior, there is this element of seeking a satisfaction, seeking an advantage, seeking some gain for oneself. It is not merely in the married relationship. This applies to all human relations. And only when this element is not present, then the love can be said to be pure or unselfish. Then, when there is not this expectation, when it is not geared, let me say, to some anticipation, some unspoken agreement, then it is spontaneous. And there is always freedom when there is no expectation. I have to do with you. There is a certain relationship between us, and suppose I expect nothing from you. There is no disappointment, then my whole action is spontaneous. It is absolutely free. It is not determined by the expectation in any way. If I seek your vote, for instance, then I will try to please you, and my whole behavior will be altered by this expectation of your vote or your support, whatever it may be. Suppose I seek nothing at all from you, then first of all, there is no question of my being disappointed. Secondly, my behavior is just natural. It is not altered in any manner. And whatever word I speak will be a true word, because if there is this expectation of a favor to be gained, then of course my words have to be accordingly ingratiating. You know, you have to adopt a certain tone, an approach which will be pleasing. You have to say the words which the other person wants you to say. You have to pretend to agree with him when you don't. You have to conceal your differences between points of view, his own and yours. So many things arise when we depart from being ourselves. I do not know how else to express it. Now, I think this is important to understand, that all spiritual relationships are relationships which are free. The relationship between a true teacher or master and his pupil. It is not what people think it to be. People think that the master molds his pupil. The pupil has to obey and follow the master. It is something in which one person is dominant. It's a relationship in which one person is dominant and the other is subservient. It is not so. If it is a spiritual relationship, all relationships of a great being are essentially spiritual, because every relationship is an expression of yourself. And he being purely spiritual, the relationship has also to be spiritual. And therefore, in every such relationship, there is an increase of freedom. That is to say, an increase of the sense of freedom. There is always freedom. The pupil always grows in the luxuriance of purity and freedom, as a flower grows in the sunlight. It is that's the kind of relationship which exists between the true teacher and the pupil. I underline the word true because if there is one true teacher, there are dozens who are merely pretenders. They are only so-called teachers. They set up shop, of course, and they invite customers, and they are usually surrounded by a band of pupils who flatter them the whole time. And anyhow, the pupil is convenient because he can wash the clothes of the teacher and do such things. So you see that they are not the real teachers. The real teacher is very, very different. The real teacher is one who embodies the truth in himself. It is only in an atmosphere of freedom that there can be the opening out, the blossoming of one's own pure nature. There is no other way. That is why it is so important to realize the necessity of freedom, not in the superficial sense, as I have already explained, but a kind of internal freedom. It is only in that condition, in the fresh air, in the open space, that there can take place this extraordinary phenomenon of the blossoming of the soul, which is the spiritual nature, which is an unearthly nature. It is not a worldly nature. It is something entirely different. It has a beauty which you cannot conceive, which it is impossible for the mind to conceive that beauty. It has been said that all arts aspire to the condition of music. You know, architecture, sculpture, painting, everything, as it were, is aspiring towards, is tending towards that beauty, that pliability, that indefinability which exists in music. In the same way, I think it would be true to say that all external beauty of whatever sort, beauty in movement, in color, in sound, in form, in everything, all aspires to and is synthesized in, and more than synthesized, in beauty of the soul. I do not know whether this is a comprehensible statement. There can be such extraordinary beauty within oneself that it far surpasses and transcends any kind of beauty of a limited sort which you may find anywhere in the world. It is a kind of loveliness which is indefinable. All true beauty, beauty in an utterly spiritual sense, is something which cannot be defined. It cannot be described. It's, to use a very poor simile, it's like the ratio between the diameter and the circumference of a circle. You know, they say that you can never put it in round numbers. You cannot express it at all. The figures go on and on. It's like the canon of proportion. You know, the architects sometimes speak of a canon of proportion, which can only be approximately defined, but can never be absolutely defined. That is to say, you go into some room. Let us say like the Parthenon in Athens. Well, you find that there is the length, the breadth, and the height or the depth. You find that it is extraordinarily beautiful. That is to say, if you are susceptible to that beauty, other people may just go there and say, we have a very fine view from this place. It's built of marble. They must have worked over it long ago. It's an excellent piece of work. And then pass on to something else, perhaps a cinema film which may be there, Cleopatra or whatever else it may be. You know that, how people, you know, such a superficial appreciation of things. Now, but if you are susceptible, you know that there is something which is indefinable. You cannot say what it is in the proportion which affects you, but it is indefinable, and that is really the canon of proportion which has been spoken of. All expressions of beauty in the truest sense, not so-called beauty, are squarings of the circle of infinity, if I may put it that way. You know, that which is eternal, it cannot be expressed. It is like a circle, which in fact is a symbol of eternity. But when you try to express something, it is like putting the contents of the circle in a square. And you can put it approximately, of course, but you can never absolutely square that circle. Consider what can be the relationship between a person and a thing. It's not merely relationship between one human being and another. That is why I use the title of law of right relationship with everything. I myself think that this freedom within oneself that I am speaking of is not compatible with any sense of possession. For this reason, what you possess possesses you. You know you have certain possessions, and if you stick to them very strongly, if you don't sort of hold them lightly, you will find that your mind is possessed by the very thing that you call your possession. In reality, there is no such thing as possession. The thing is there, I am here, how can I possess that? I cannot possess it. But possession means something else. It's a demarcation of responsibility. There are certain things to which I am related which come within the domain of my control. For the use of them, I am responsible either to myself or to somebody else. So there is an area of responsibility and control, and whatever comes within that area are your possessions, but you cannot actually, you being this inner being, you cannot actually possess that external thing. It is just not possible. But we all use the word possession very freely. Possession is really karmic rather than spiritual, if I may put it like that. Karma has placed various things in under my control. They happen to me to be in my possession, so-called. That is all. All possessions are only possessions, so-called. They are here for the time. They are gone away tomorrow. And all possession ceases when the life comes to an end. You go on to other possessions, perhaps, in the next life. So we see that the spirit does not possess anything. It has no race. It has no nationality. It has no religion, because its own nature is the religion. It's a sacred nature. And the essence of religion consists in that sacredness, that absolute absence of self. So the soul has no race, no nationality, no religion, and it cannot possess anything. It is eternally pure. It is untouched. It is alone. It stands apart from everything else. There is, in the Quran, or in one of the sayings of Muhammad, I believe it is in the Quran, they say, nothing in the world can be compared to God. God is a principle of substance. They regard God as a person who is incomparable, because there is nothing like him anywhere. You think of any substance, any person, anything. You cannot compare it to God, because it is something which does not lend itself to comparison with anything else. It's an absolutely unique thing. That is the nature of the one spirit. They use the word God. But it doesn't matter. We can always take the sense out of all these statements. So there is a principle in nature which is apart from everything else. And that is the self-existent thing. And yet it is that which pervades everything, which is everywhere, which is incomparable, which cannot be touched, which is alone all the time, which is essentially pure. It is insusceptible to corruption. That is the one universal spirit. Of course, that spirit enters into the human being. A ray of it exists in each one, and the whole effort of nature is to bring that nature of the human being into conformity with the nature of that divine ray which is within himself. In all human relations, the attitude which really vitiates is the using of the other person for the satisfaction of one's own desires. You then turn the other person into an object. He is no longer a human being. You do not consider his feelings, his welfare, his happiness, his joy. He is merely a thing like so many other things. And if you can get another thing, a machine, to take the place of the human being, then immediately you will get it, because he is much more under your own control than this other human being. So the whole attitude to avoid, I think, is, what gain can I make of you? How can I use you for my purpose? In what way can I turn this contact to my advantage? All that kind of thinking, whether subconscious or conscious, is an approach with an ulterior motive, with a design. You must have no designs on other human beings. You must leave them alone. You love them, you respect them, but have no design upon them. All commercial men have designs on their fellow human beings. They are thinking all the time of how they can sell the goods which they produce or which they are commissioned to sell. All commercial men are people who have designs upon you, which they express very freely. You find it on all the billboards, on the roads. All propagandists are designing people, every missionary, because he wants to convert the other person. It is not sufficient for him to meet the other person as a human being, but he must be made into this or that or whatever else it may be. They all have their designs. Now, can we approach another? I hope we have no designs as theosophists on our fellow human beings. Now, can we approach another without seeking to use him for our purposes? Just the human approach. Merely try to see him as he is. See what is nice. You also see something which is crude and ugly. But can you help him on his way to whatever extent you can? Just meet him like that with affection, with interest, and then pass on. Nothing more. I think that is really a beautiful relationship. And that is really true in a sense, because you have no design, no purpose of your own to serve, no ulterior motive, nothing at the background of my mind. You are not approaching the person for your own purpose, any purpose, whatever that purpose may be. I think that everything in the universe, I think, not in order to be dogmatic, but in order to qualify myself, it may not be the absolute truth. My statement may need to be corrected. So if I don't use those words, I think, it would be really a dogmatic statement. So I think that everything in the universe exists primarily for its own sake, in its own right. Of course it exists, we may say, also to serve others. Or we might put it this way, it is capable of serving others. That would be the better way to put it. Capable of serving others. We serve others best when we are ourselves in the true sense. You must be yourself. You must, you know, above all be true to thine own self. Then it follows as night the day that thou canst not be false to any other man. One has to be true to himself. It is only when we are ourselves in the truest sense that we can really help other people. Otherwise, we help them, so to say, with our ideas. But the ideas are all generated from our own particular conditioning, our reactions, our hopes, our wishes, our fears, and so on. But we have to be ourselves. That is, when we are not twisting ourselves, insinuating ourselves, overreaching ourselves, performing any kind of a feat with ourselves, it is only when we just approach the other person in an absolutely simple, natural way that we can really help the other person. Otherwise, we may think we help, and it may be a little help, but it is not real help. It is only so-called. Take the case of an animal. What is our attitude towards an animal? We see the squirrels, we see the goats, we see the cows, we see so many animals. An animal is really a stream of divine life, as every human being is. Everything is such a stream, the blade of grass, the tree. Everything is a stream of divine life. The omnipresence is everywhere. To use religious terms, God is in everything and is the essence of everything. So it is also a part of the universal process of evolution. So the divine life in the animal, even if it be the tiger or whatever it may be, an animal which we do not want to approach, even if it be that, it is unfolding according to its own inner pattern, according to its own nature. According to that word, you know, in the beginning was the word, but that word is everywhere. Its reverberations, its vibrations reach into everything. So there is the word in everything. The word means how its destiny, how it should evolve. The whole nature of it as it is intended to evolve. A word is a formulation, is it not? It is a thought. So there is that inner thought in everything. So it is unfolding. It is there to enjoy life. It is there to contact the world in its own manner. Even if it's a butterfly, it contacts the world in its own way, which is very different from our way. It is there to feel the joy of its motions, to experience the expansion of its life, to make its own responses. It is for this purpose that the animal, the insect, the bird, the earthworm, everything exists. It's an extraordinary idea that everything in the world or even in the universe exists for our pleasure, for our enjoyment. You know, this is a very common idea. But the question is, do we also share that idea? Do we think that all the stars are there to light us at night, and the sun and the moon are there to light us during daytime or nighttime or whatever it may be? It's a completely homocentric, self-centered, prison house view. We are within the prison of our own thoughts, and we think that the whole universe is a kind of spectacle that just revolves around this center, which is ourselves or myself. Of course it is true, as I said, everything exists also to serve others in this marvelously interdependent world. So in a sense it is true that everything exists to render the service which it can perform. But the question is, what is the true service which is to be performed by that thing? Not what you think may be as service. Because we want to turn everything into a means for our own gratification and satisfaction. We also exist to serve. In the service which we render, without any motive of self-advancement or even self-fulfillment, that is, it is in such service that our own true unfoldment lies. I said self-fulfillment. The fulfillment of life is one thing. The fulfillment of self is another. Life always expands. It grows as the flower grows. It manifests a new pattern. It is like a stream which enters into larger ways. That is its natural fulfillment. But my fulfillment is what I think I want. If I get it, that is my fulfillment. You see, self-fulfillment is one thing. The real fulfillment of life, the expansion of it, the expression of it from stage to stage, from moment to moment, is something entirely different. So it is only in service, without any motive, that one can unfold his nature. There is no other way. I said a little while ago, it is only in an atmosphere of freedom. But these two statements are not contradictory. When you give without expecting anything, you are free and you are unfolding yourself. There is both freedom and unfoldment. The great ones, the adepts, the masters, they serve all beings. They serve all life because their relationships are universal. So we have always to consider, do we give at least as much as we receive in life? We will never value anything rightly until we cease to think of it in terms of how we can turn it to our own advantage. We must think of it as it is in itself. Suppose I give you some examples. Suppose you look at a flower as it is on its stem. If you just look at the flower, look at its beauty, its fragrance, whatever it may be, the whole impression that it produces upon your mind or upon your soul. Well, that is one thing. But if you think of the flower, the moment you look at it, you think it would be nice to have it as a decoration in my room. you know, immediately you want to make use of that beauty for your own satisfaction in the room. That vitiates the appreciation. If there is that thought, it's not possible to appreciate purely. You cannot give your heart to the flower when you are thinking of the flower to serve, to be a way of satisfaction for you, sitting upon your vase or somewhere else it may be in the room. I don't say we should not have flowers in the house, but what is our thought when we meet the flower? Suppose you look at a precious stone, a sapphire, or whatever it may be, ruby or diamond. Do we admire it for its luster, for its purity, for all that it represents, or do we immediately think how nice it will be on my finger? Even if this is the next thought, the moment you see this precious stone, then you really do not appreciate the precious stone. You don't know what it is. You don't know its loveliness. The self has injected itself immediately into that relationship with the stone. So we see that we don't come into direct relationship or a deep relationship with a thing when we are merely thinking of how we can use it for our purposes. As I said, I don't say we should not use them. We can't merely admire the cornfield and pass. We have to eat the corn, I suppose. So we have to use the things. But you can use them respecting them, acknowledging the fact that it exists in its own right, appreciating its individuality. You can have a certain respect. I do not find any other word, even for things which are inanimate. So can't we all look at things, everything, whatever it may be, appreciate it for whatever it may be worth, without reference to ourselves. Value each thing as it stands. That is an integral aspect of the relationship which we form with things. You know, the relationship is something universal. Relationship with every human being, every animal, relationship with nature, relationship with things, relationship with whatever you read in the books and so on and so forth. All our values are based upon three things. One is enjoyment. We want to enjoy. You can see how much of our thinking is based upon the notion of enjoyment. The value of everything depends upon the extent to which it can contribute to your own enjoyment, to my own enjoyment. I am not excluding myself. And when so we seek enjoyment or comfort or whatever it may be, and in order to ensure the continuance of this enjoyment, we need possession. I need to possess a thing in order to continue to enjoy it. Therefore, possession is another value. And if I have a possession, then it may sort of disintegrate, it may pass away, it may melt away. So there has to be security for the possession. So that is another value. We see our values: enjoyment, possession, security. All are values of the self. But the true values are the values of the intrinsic nature of things, its own intrinsic nature. And this intrinsic nature, you may say, how are we to perceive it? It will unfold itself to us. If we approach it with absolute objectivity, that is to say, seeking nothing for ourselves. If you can, that is true objectivity. The scientists are objective only up to a point. The scientist has all the weaknesses and the passions and so on that we suffer from. He is not such an extraordinary being, a new class by himself. He is objective in reference to what he wants to study and examine. But a human being has to arrive at this state of absolute objectivity in which he can see everything in life just as it is. When there is no self-seeking, there will be love. So objectivity and love, they go together. Both are aspects of the true nature of man, of the spiritual nature. But unfortunately, the word spiritual has become so warped, it has become impregnated with meanings which are alien to itself. The spiritual nature is that nature which is ever pure, ever uncontaminated, in the midst of things, and it cannot be touched either by the hand or by a mind which is still unregenerate, that is to say, the worldly mind. It is that nature which is ever fresh, to which everything is ever new, which never becomes stale, which suffers no change that can alter its newness. Nothing can make it old. There is an ancient hymn, it is addressed to Purusha. It's a Sanskrit word. Purusha is usually translated as spirit. That's the one universal spirit which manifests itself in each individual thing. And this hymn speaks of Purusha, this is extraordinarily interesting, as being constantly in a state of being born. You know, just being born. Every moment it's being born. It's in a state of being about to be born. It is just going to be born. In each and everything in which it dwells, that is the nature of the spirit. In other words, it is ever fresh. It is newborn. It has that innocence. Of course, you may say, why do they say Purusha as he? It may be she, it may be it. Perhaps it should be it. But there is a reason perhaps for using the word he. In nature, what is being born is he. What gives birth is she. So you can see that there is a certain appropriateness in using this word with regard to Purusha or the Christ child. You say he. That is because it symbolizes what is being born. But that which gives birth, that immaculate nature of which I spoke, it is she, it is feminine. So the relationship which is best, which is true, which is wonderful, is that in which there is no staleness, in which there is no indifference, in which there is an ever fresh interest, in which the beauty, the individuality, the value in each thing is revealed from moment to moment. And it is also a relationship in which each gives of himself without expecting a return. Not a relationship of alliance. Alliance is for a certain common purpose. But a cooperation which is spontaneous, which is born out of pure affection. And such a relationship constantly enriches the other person, but without excluding others. If I have a relationship of affection towards you, I shouldn't gang up with you to the exclusion of the rest of the world. That should not be the case. We mustn't lose our sympathy, our interest in the whole world because we are concentrated upon one person. We can concentrate. Concentrate is not the best word. You can give all your affection to one person, but still the quantum of affection remains the same. You give it to another person, it still remains the same, it is inexhaustible. You can give the whole of yourself to one person, to one thing, still the whole remains, and that whole can be given once again. It's an extraordinary thing, this nature. It's a relationship of beauty, but that does not stand static, that alters from moment to moment. It's like a song in which there is always a new note. But with every turn, it is expressive. It is expressive at every turn. That's the kind of relationship. Of course, it is a comparison. What is the song? It's the song of the eternal in the succession of time. That is to say, the relationship should reflect, even though it is a relationship in time, something of the quality of what is timeless.